There's some underlying issues such as when does life begin? What's meaningful life? When does life end? When is it right to, quote, play God? I don't think it's reasonable to expect that we're ever going to reach complete agreement on these kinds of questions. Well, that's a little bit of background. Let's get down to specifics. Talk about a specific technology that has burst onto the scene within really the last 3 years. July 25th, 1978, baby Louise was born in England. Got slide, let's see. That's baby Louise up there on the left. She got almost all of the publicity since she was the first one. The little fellow screaming down in the bottom right-hand corner didn't have as good a press agent, but his name is Alistair Montgomery. His parents are from Scotland, and he was also a, quote, test tube baby produced by the same team. I'll show you a picture of one of them. Patrick Steptoe is one of the people, and another fellow, Robert Edwards, are the two who collaborated on developing this technique and first applying it to humans. When baby Louise was born, about a month later, there was a Gallup poll taken, and an astonishing 93% of the people in the United States interviewed had heard about the birth of baby Louise, and that is probably a higher percentage than would be able to identify the President of the United States. Let's see here. This is baby Louise at 7 months. She's, I guess she's just a little over 3 years old now, as far as anyone can tell. She's a perfectly healthy, normal, rambunctious baby. This is Patrick Steptoe. He's the gynecologist who did part of the work. We'll talk about the procedure in a minute, but he's the person who removed the egg, and the fertilization that was carried out in the laboratory was done by his collaborator named Robert Edwards. I don't have a picture of him. And then the fertilized egg, the embryo, after a certain length of time when it was re-implanted in the woman, Steptoe again did that work. So he removed the egg and he did the implantation work. Shortly after his fame occurred, he was forced to retire. There's a law in England that you have to retire at age 65, and he had just turned 65. So now he and this other fellow are setting up a clinic in Cambridge, a private clinic. That same Gallup poll, where most of the people had heard of the birth of baby Louise, 42% of the people could, at least in rough outline, describe the procedure. Test tube baby is really not a very good term. It's not a scientifically respectable term. It conjures up in the minds of at least a few people the baby being grown in test tubes, which obviously was not the case. Let's just take a minute and talk a little bit about the procedure. More technically, it's called in vitro fertilization. Now, in vitro is Latin for in glass. Figuratively speaking, it simply means in using laboratory glassware or hardware. And the contrast is in vivo, which takes place in the body. In vitro is taking something that normally occurs in the body and doing it outside of the body instead. And it's the fertilization that was done there. The first task is to obtain the egg, and this is removed from the ovary just prior to when ovulation would normally occur. There are two ways of doing this. One method, which is now being used by an Australian team, is to help trigger ovulation by some hormone therapy. Some people who are having fertility treatment will get hormone therapy and it will actually cause superovulation, more than one egg is released. And when you read about a couple having sex couplets and various multiple births, usually this is a result of a number of eggs being released as a result of hormone therapy. So the timing can be set by administering this hormone and then going in a certain time after that. The method that Stepton Edwards did was a little bit more natural. What they did is worked out a pattern for determining when the egg was just about to be released. There's a hormone that shows up in the urine, and 21 hours later it's just about ripe and ready to be released. Well, whichever timing method is used. There's then a little device which is indicated there on the left. It's called a laparoscope, and this was invented by Steptoe. And though it's used in this technique, it also is used in other medical practices as well. It amounts to a little probe with fiber optics. You can look through it and see what's going on in there. Usually some gas is pumped into the abdominal cavity to open up some space so that this can be inserted. Then there's basically a little blister on the ovary where the egg is about to be released, and then a little suction apparatus, just a little bit of a glass suction needle. They just made it in their laboratory from some ordinary glassware. With the suction, the egg is simply taken out, and then the fertilization occurs after that. To give you an idea how fast they can do this, a general anesthetic is used. Once the anesthesia takes place, and this occurs in about 10 minutes, the quickest that they've ever gotten the egg from that point on is 80 seconds. So they really have it honed to a fine art. Continuing on with the procedure then, the egg is incubated with sperm, usually maintained together for several hours. Fertilization is usually accomplished within 3 hours or so. There is a special solution that has to be used to enable the sperm to be able to fertilize the egg. A regular sperm, as it leaves the male, is not able to fertilize the egg. It has to be able to cut through the wall of the egg, penetrate to do the fertilizing. And normally this ability is acquired by the sperm as it swims through the female tract on its way to the egg. Well, this of course doesn't happen in a test tube fertilization, but there are some chemical manipulations that are done to make the sperm capable of doing this. Okay, then the egg is fertilized. We'll use the term embryo from here on. Embryo is usually used for about the first 2, sometimes 3, but more commonly 2 months of development of the fertilized egg, and then we use the term fetus from then on. There is some question of how long to let the embryo develop once fertilization takes place. In the early work, fertilized egg was just kept with some nutrients in a laboratory dishware for about 4 days. It then reached about a 64-cell stage, and that's a stage in development where implantation most commonly occurs in a natural pregnancy, and so they thought that that would probably be the optimum way to go. However, they have, by trial and error, without understanding why very well. They now don't let the embryo develop that long in the laboratory. It goes now about two and a half days, gets to about the 8 or 16 cell stage, and then is implanted. They're finding out that they really haven't got figured out yet the right conditions for laboratory growth. And the longer it's maintained in the laboratory, in the, if you will, unnatural environment, the more likely the development doesn't proceed as it normally would. Then the implantation is done. In the early days of, the early days harking back to about 1970, in the early days, this procedure was done surgically, but no longer is it done that way. Now a catheter, a soft tube, is simply inserted through the female tract into the uterus, and the embryo at the suitable stage of development is passed through. The woman has to, of course, be at the right stage in the menstrual cycle when implantation normally would occur. And frequently there's hormone therapy that's given about this time to make sure that the uterus is in the right hormonal state so that implantation might occur. It's physically a pretty simple procedure, the implantation, but it's been frustratingly difficult to get the implantations to take, for reasons not fully understood. Steptoe and Edwards have found that the only time that their implantations have worked is if they attempt them between 10 o'clock at night and midnight. It was by sheer accident that they stumbled onto this the first time. With baby Louise, they came to the laboratory about 6 o'clock in the evening with the intention of doing the implantation. And the embryo was only up to the 6-cell stage, and they wanted it to be 8-cell before they were, they just felt better about having it that far along before they tried it. So they sat around in the laboratory for a while, and things weren't progressing too rapidly. They went out to dinner, sat around, came back to the laboratory. Finally, about 11 o'clock, it got up to the 8-cell stage. They went with it, and it worked. And they had about 80 different women with whom they have tried this procedure, and they've had 4 successful implantations. This was as of about a year and a half ago, and all of them were here. They think it has something to do with the daily hormonal pattern, but that's about all they can say about it. There's also some debate about whether to use that hormone treatment to trigger ovulation, whether that follows up the uterus later on for the implantation to have the right hormone environment. Well, the advent of this technique spawned some cartoons. We're making a baby. There's one. I think I've got a couple more here for you. Now, for the last time, Jeffrey, you are not adopted. And finally, that's my boy. That's it on the slides. By the way, I'm going to leave some time for discussion, but if at any point, if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to, I was going to look that up. I can't tell you. Clomiphene, does that sound right? I think there's a clomiphene is one thing. There, HCG is another thing. That there are a number of different, that's human chorionogonadotropin. There's a luteinizing hormone that they look for, and 21 hours after the surge in the urine, they go in. There are a variety of recipes currently in use. Although Steptoe and Edwards, these people in England, have gotten most of the publicity, there's only been 2 babies born as a result of their efforts, and there's a team in Australia
that there have been about 8 babies since born. There's maybe one in India. I'll comment on that in a minute. There's a question mark about that. There are none in the United States yet. There is a clinic in Norfolk, Virginia, Eastern Virginia Medical School, that's been in operation. It's a private clinic. There's a real question about using state or public funds anyway for this. It's a private clinic, and they've been in operation for about a year and a half with no success, except about a month ago, 2 months ago maybe, they announced that there was a pregnancy in progress. Now, they've said that they want to keep a low profile so that there's not too much publicity surrounding the procedure. But despite all the publicity, there are only at best a dozen babies in the world at the moment as a result of this procedure. And furthermore, a lot of the excitement about it for helping certain types of infertility, which we'll get into shortly, has really not panned out yet, because the procedure has not been worked out nearly well enough to ensure any high percentage of success for those parties who are engaging in it. So at the moment, there's a lot more promise than meeting that promise. Okay, what are the situations in which this technique would be used? The most common situation, and the only situation so far that anybody has publicly said they're trying it for, is in a situation where a female has oviduct damage of some kind, so that the egg, when released, can't freely pass through the oviduct, and it's, or fallopian tube, if you like. In the oviduct, that's where the fertilization normally occurs. If there's some kind of a blockage, scarring, there are a number of ways that this can occur. This is a barrier to pregnancy occurring. In fact, it's probably the most common reason for infertility in females. An estimated 300,000 women in the United States alone have this condition, and this procedure is, at least in theory, might be beneficial for them. Now, this is the only situation so far where it's been used, and so far it's been restricted to married couples. There are some other possibilities. There is speculation that if we have a couple where the male has a low or marginal sperm count, perhaps having the fertilization take place outside the body and having all the sperm reach the egg and have an opportunity to fertilize it, there might be some advantage in a situation like that. But at the moment, the other difficulties outweigh that one, and that doesn't look very promising. Genetic risks is another possibility. There is no reason, there's no biological requirement that the woman who supplies the egg be the woman in whom the embryo is planted back in. You might think there would be a rejection problem. There isn't. The embryo is partially, there's a barrier so that the immune system doesn't really attack the embryo. In a way, that makes sense, because you can think of the fact that a given woman is capable of bearing a very wide range of genetically different children. I mean, the immune system must be able to tolerate, if you will, a very broad range of characteristics. If we had a situation where the woman knew she was a carrier for a disorder like muscular dystrophy, this is a disorder carried, the most common situation is it's carried by the woman, and if there is a boy baby, there's a 50% chance that the boy will have the disorder. Now, there are things that you can do during pregnancy to get information about the fetus. You can determine the sex of the fetus during the pregnancy, and the couple can make a decision as to whether to proceed with the pregnancy. But at the moment, there isn't a reliable test for muscular dystrophy itself. So you could have a situation of simply knowing you have a boy and there's a 50% chance. If it's a girl, there's a 50% chance of being a carrier, but there isn't a risk of having the disorder. There is some thought that because the embryo is produced outside the body, it might be possible to examine the embryo before implanting it for at least certain characteristics. The sex could be identified. And in fact, in rabbits, they've used this method experimentally. It's possible to take a few cells off and do some analytical work, apparently without damaging the embryo. And you can identify sex. You could identify something like Down syndrome, where an extra chromosome would show up. It might be possible to do a certain limited amount of screening before implantation. No one's tried that with humans, and the state of the art isn't there yet at all. One other situation is that suppose a woman is unable to have a pregnancy because of a health problem, a heart problem, kidney problem, maybe she had a hysterectomy, what have you. It would be possible still for her to donate the egg. Her husband, for example, could donate the sperm, and the embryo could be implanted in another woman. A surrogate mother, if you will, would bear a child, and then the biological mother and father, in this case, would adopt the child. That's another possible application. And Steptoe has, in fact, said that that's an application he would consider in his clinic, but nobody, to our knowledge, has done it. It also might be possible to freeze embryos for a while before implanting them. I mentioned that one baby maybe was born in India by this technique. The scientists there claim that the embryo had been stored frozen for about a month before they implanted it. You might wonder why would you want to do this? With animal breeding, there would be an advantage in terms of making sure that the female was at the right stage in the cycle for implantation. You could produce all these embryos and just hold them in livestock breeding until the female was at the right stage for implantation. There has also been some work done if you want to go for multiple pregnancies. Suppose a couple has been frustrated for a number of years in trying to have a child in the normal way and now is turning to this procedure and in a sense wants to make up for lost time and get on with the family more rapidly. In theory, you could implant more than one. And in fact, there was an Australian couple, bore twins, produced by this method. Now, I don't think one was frozen there. I think in that case, two eggs were produced at one time due to this superovulation. They were both fertilized and implanted. But freezing would be the way you could do that. Well, while all this was going on in England, there was a big hubbub going on in the United States about whether it was ethically appropriate to do this. And there was a federal order barring the use of federal funds for any of this work until an ethics committee could examine the practice and make a recommendation as to whether there should be public funding for this. They went around the country to about 12 different places, took public testimony. Let me just give you two quotes that appeared in the newspaper of conflicting points of view. In Detroit, a woman who was sterile, who in theory could be, this technique could be appropriate for, said, "Please don't do us any favors. My concern is for the thousands, perhaps millions of unborn humans who will be sacrificed to produce one. It is not worth the price to allow us to be natural parents." What she's referring to is the fact that with this procedure, there will be situations where embryos are produced by test tube fertilization and are not implanted. For those who consider the embryo to have the right to life, to use a popular phrase, this is at least a cousin of abortion and therefore wrong. Now this is where she was coming from. Another woman, also sterile, disagreed and said, "My husband and I desperately want a family. It seems to me that when there are many moral and ethical issues surrounding the legalization of such a procedure, these issues are overridden by the desires and hopes of the American men and women whose only hope may be found in the procedure." Okay, let me just run through several of the issues, and then I'd like to open it up and see what reactions or views you might have. One of the really key issues is the fact that embryos are produced and not implanted with the procedure. If superovulation is done, if this hormone therapy is used so that a number of eggs are produced, the fertilization is done, usually not all the embryos are going to be implanted. Sometimes there can be examination of the embryos too, just to look for abnormalities, and judgments are made as to whether it's advisable to go ahead with the implantation. So that's a very crucial issue. I was going to say a bit about the arguments of when does a human being come into existence and run through some of the arguments, but I'll come back to that if we have time. I think I'll move on to some of the other issues, though. Another issue is that an embryo obviously cannot consent to be a party to what can be characterized as an experiment. I mean, we allow new medical procedures to be used with humans, but we do so provided that there is informed consent, that the parties understand what the risks are, what the likely benefits are, and under those conditions, they have a right to decide how they want to proceed. Okay, we could argue the embryo is a party to this experiment and obviously isn't involved in giving consent. The counterargument to that is that an embryo never gives consent, obviously, and there are a number of conventional pregnancies which could really be considered experiments to a substantial extent. Genetic counselors report that there are substantial numbers of couples who know that they have, for example, a 1 in 4 chance of having a child with a serious defect that can't, in some cases, it can't be diagnosed during the pregnancy. They go ahead with the pregnancy, hope everything will come out for the best. Certainly, health habits during pregnancy potentially can endanger embryos and fetuses. They don't have much to say about those experiments either. What is the risk factor, though? How big a risk is it? There's a fellow by the name of Leon Cass. He teaches bioethics at the University of Chicago. And he said this: "It is one thing to accept voluntarily the risk of a dangerous procedure for yourself. It is quite a different thing deliberately to submit a hypothetical or unborn child to hazardous procedures which can in no way be considered therapeutic for him and are therapeutic for you only in that they treat your desires, albeit unobjectionable ones. Morally, it is insufficient that your motives are good, your ends are unobjectionable, that you do the procedure lovingly, and even that you may be lucky in the result. You will be engaging, nonetheless, in an unethical experiment upon a human subject." Now, this relates to the consent issue as well. But let me just say a little bit about the safety of the procedure. The fact is that we don't know very much about how safe the procedure is. There's been a fair amount of work done with animals, not primates, but with rats, mice, and so on. With them, the procedure appears to be reasonably safe. But usually when a new procedure is used with humans, it has been worked out through a series of animals up through primates before being tried with humans. This wasn't the case with this technique. And in fact, a fellow at Michigan State who works with primates has said that the work by Steptoe and Edwards is shedding a lot of light on those of us who work with monkeys, as we're using people to develop the information for those whose interest is in monkeys instead of the other way around. The work with Steptoe and Edwards, you saw the picture of the two babies who were born. By all criteria, they appear to be normal. Two is far too few to draw any conclusions on. What not nearly as many people know is that there were two other pregnancies under the work of Steptoe and Edwards, and both of them ended up in miscarriages. And an examination of the fetuses, one was at about 20 weeks and the other was at about 8 weeks. In both cases, there were genetic abnormalities.
The work with Steptoe and Edwards, you saw the picture of the two babies who were born. By all criteria, they appear to be normal. Two is far too few to draw any conclusions on. What not nearly as many people know is that there were two other pregnancies under the work of Steptoe and Edwards, and both of them ended up in miscarriages. And an examination of the fetuses, one was at about 20 weeks and the other was at about 8 weeks. In both cases, there were genetic abnormalities. So, there's a fellow at Vanderbilt who says the only really good way, without taking a chance on producing a lot of babies that might have disorders by this method, one of the best ways of checking the safety of the test-tube fertilization is to do the fertilization, maintain the embryos for a period of time, examine them, and try to draw conclusions as to whether the procedure in the laboratory results in a higher percentage of embryos with disorders than the natural procedure. He's been waiting for about 6 years to get permission to do this, and it runs into the problem that embryos are being produced that are not going to be implanted. So there's kind of a catch-22. This is one of the ways to assess safety, but you can't do it without running into the other problem. There's Paul Ramsey, who's the professor of Christian ethics at Princeton, has said this about this procedure. The decision must be that we cannot rightfully get to know how to use it without conducting unethical experiments upon the unborn who must be the mishaps through whom we learn how. On the other hand, there is always some level of uncertainty when a new procedure is used in humans. At what point is the evidence for safety high enough that it's ethically acceptable to proceed? Back in 1966, Edwards, one of the people, the Steptoe and Edwards team, wrote an article in Scientific American. This was about 4 years before he started doing the same procedure with humans. He did work with other animals prior to that time. In 1966, he wrote, "If rabbit and pig eggs can be fertilized after maturation in culture, presumably human eggs grown in culture could also be fertilized, although obviously it would not be permissible to implant them in a human recipient." He said that in 1966. In 1970, he was doing it. Well, he was collaborating with Steptoe, who was doing what obviously was not permissible 5 years earlier. The Ethics Advisory Board that went around the country taking testimony came up with the recommendation that test tube fertilization and embryo implantation was ethically acceptable under certain conditions. One is that it be restricted to a situation where a husband and a wife supply the sperm and egg and the embryo is implanted in the wife, at least initially, that we restrict it to that. And now comes another proviso that is a curious one to me, and I can only think that there was some compromising going on within the committee. The other one is that any embryo that is produced that is not implanted may not be sustained for more than 14 days. And they wanted to head off producing embryos and trying to grow them entirely in the laboratory where we know so little that the likelihood of abnormality is exceedingly high. A 14-day limit does give some room for experimental work. It certainly runs afoul of those who consider that the embryo, once produced, has the right to life. One of the people on the Ethics Advisory Board was a Catholic priest who supported the recommendation, and I don't know how he felt, obviously there was some kind of a compromise. As far as the question of public funding, the advisory board said, we don't think it should not be allowed, but whether this is a high priority for public funding is simply a decision for the budget people to decide. And they didn't suggest that it be given a high priority. And in fact, public funding hasn't been used so far. Okay, the last issue, and I'll just touch on this very briefly. One of the objections to this procedure is a belief, a religious belief, that it's God's plan that intercourse, reproduction, and marriage is a package. And each other is outside of God's plan and therefore wrong. The Catholic Church has been very outspoken on a number of the techniques in artificial insemination, for example. Even when the husband's sperm is used, there intercourse is being separated from procreation. And the Catholic Church has said that it is wrong to use artificial insemination using the husband's sperm. And certainly, even more so, if a third party donor is used. And one Catholic authority has said that the church's stand on artificial insemination would logically be extended to the test tube fertilization technique because, again, there is a separation of procreation from intercourse. Now, there's a contrasting view that the key component in marriage is a love relationship between the husband and the wife, and that providing an opportunity to have a child can actually enrich that love experience, can be a very positive thing, and that is the primary emphasis that should be occurring. Furthermore, couples who use this technique aren't choosing to separate intercourse from procreation. It isn't their choice that they are, in a sense, biologically denied the opportunity to have children in the usual way. Okay. Have I been able to jog any thoughts or questions? Yeah. Were any of you here yesterday? We discussed this with respect to artificial insemination, which is a little different situation. With artificial insemination, surrogate mothers come into play more commonly. If you have a couple where the wife is infertile, the husband supplies the sperm, and the surrogate mother then, by artificial insemination, conceives the child, bears a child, but in that case, she is a genetic parent as well as the person who had the pregnancy. understand, the laws vary somewhat from state to state, but the surrogate mother in that case is likely to have a very strong claim. And in fact, there have been cases already tried where the surrogate mother, after going through the experience of pregnancy, changed her mind and felt a strong bond to the baby and decided she wanted to keep the baby. And this may happen even if a contract is written. Courts have ruled that the surrogate mother, at least in some cases, can have custody of the child. But in that case, the surrogate mother has a genetic claim as well as a claim in terms of having carried through the pregnancy. With the test of fertilization, the claim would be probably not quite as strong. And the answer is, my answer is that one hasn't been tested yet. What do you have a thought on what you would advocate on something like that? Suppose a surrogate mother, I'm not asking you legally now, if someone here is a legal expert, that expertise is valuable too, but I guess I'm really asking you how you think it ought to be. Suppose a couple and a surrogate mother enter into that arrangement, and the surrogate mother changes her mind. Should she be honor-bound to honor her original commitment? One thing I might comment is that, at least with artificial insemination, when surrogate mothers are used, at least when an arrangement is made by some third party, there's a recommendation that surrogate mothers be women who are already married and who already have had children. They have had the experience of pregnancy. They know what they're getting into, if you will. They already have children of their own and a family. The thinking is that they're less likely to be surprised by the bond that develops during pregnancy. Not that it won't still develop, but it might not. That problem might not occur as often in that situation. Yeah. That one's up for grabs. Now, surrogate mothers are often paid a fee. $10,000 is about the going rate for their services plus medical expenses. And you might make the argument that if they've entered into a contract for money, that there might be a stronger obligation to honor the arrangement. In a sense, they're being paid for their services. Okay, yeah, two good questions. Let me first comment on the genetic disorders themselves. One of the genetic disorders involved a trisomic condition. There was an extra chromosome. I don't know which one it was. It wasn't one of the sex chromosomes, and it wasn't 21 Down. The other disorder was apparently a kind of a mild one. The Y chromosome was enlarged. Okay. The Steptoe and Edwards have said that in all of their pregnancies, that have proceeded far enough, and this means about 16 weeks in, they have in fact done amniocentesis, a procedure was possible to check for certain genetic disorders. Now, there's just too many genetic disorders to check for them all, but you can look at the chromosomes and you could do selective chemical tests as well. They have done this. However, a really interesting thing to my way of thinking, this Indian team who allegedly used a frozen embryo, they were asked, did you do amniocentesis on the at that stage in pregnancy? And they said no. And they asked them why, and they said, well, the procedure itself carries a risk. It's a very small risk, probably less than 1%. Of inducing a miscarriage, at least in hospitals where the procedure is done regularly and the people are familiar with the technique. There is this very slight risk. And they said, we would rather have an abnormal baby be born than risk interrupting this experiment inadvertently by doing amniocentesis. And I think there's a sense of priorities there which are somewhat chilling to me. Another interesting thing on that one is that they were working under a research grant on trying to combat the population problem. I mean, India, of course, has a bit of a problem with overpopulation, and here they were doing work on another technique by which infertile people could have babies. So they raised quite a storm. Steptoe and Edward. I don't know if there's the kids have been pretty periodically checked, but there's only two kids to check at the moment. And I don't know whether there's a long-term, longitudinal study on this. There's such a small number, I'm not sure how much confidence anyone would have in the results anyway. But somebody else had... Tests with animals, though, really just have failed to find much problem with it. Viability is the criterion currently used by the Supreme Court. However, that's going to get in big trouble because viability keeps getting earlier and earlier as our technology improves. In fact, there was a baby born in San Diego at 21 weeks that has now survived. And when the Supreme Court made their ruling, 24 to 28 weeks was considered generally the stage of viability. And the time, it's a ways away, but the time probably will come where the technology is there to support a child entirely outside the body. There isn't a way yet known to get the placenta to develop in the laboratory, and without the fetal lifeline that the placenta is getting the things to work. The solution isn't in sight, but as a scientist, I'd have to say I'd be foolish to think that there isn't a solution to it. Now, whether we would want to use it, that will bring up some very interesting problems, because decisions to abort will not necessarily carry the implication that the fetus is going to die. An abortion will simply be a question of whether to remove the fetus from the body of the mother. Then there's the additional question of what level of support to provide the fetus to give the fetus the opportunity to develop further. In this last year, in the Washington State Legislature, a law was passed that any aborted fetus had to be provided the full medical care that's available if it is alive. You can pick up brain wave activity at about 13 weeks for a fetus in the womb. At 16 weeks, the brain activity comes from the cortex, the thinking part of the brain that distinguishes humans from other animals. It's not until about the 28th week that you get the full development of the cortex, and there are those who feel that a fetus can't really feel pain until about then. However, for fetuses that are removed, you can pick up brainwave activity, if that's your sole criterion, and I talked about where it comes from as early as about 7 weeks. Yeah. So even if a person like me were to say brainwave activity has certain satisfying characteristics, that really doesn't dispense with the problem of what kind of brainwave activity do you need. Did you have it?
I think it's really hard to stop
Let me just close on that. There was a letter to Time magazine after they had run a big special issue on when does at least a person or a human being, what term you use and how you define it really defines how the argument goes. But somebody wrote in and said, what we really should do legally is say that we don't define anyone as a person until 21 years of age unless they have a crew cut and are clean shaven and certain other characteristics, then we're free to do what we want with them.